Welcome to Inspiration and Transformation from the Banks of the Ganga with Sadhvi Bhagwati Saraswati, an American sannyasi living at the Parmarth Nikatan Ashram in Rishikesh, India. Sadhvi is president of the Divine Shakti Foundation, a charitable organization bringing education, vocational training, upliftment, and empowerment programs to women and children. Sadhvi is also Secretary General of the Global Interfaith WASH Alliance and Director of the world-famous International Yoga Festival. Join the musings of an American sannyasi as Sadhvi shares the wisdom and teachings of her guru, His Holiness Pujya Swami Chidanand Saraswatiji.
Welcome, everyone, to Inspiration and Transformation from the Holy Banks of the sacred Ganga River in the land of Rishikesh, India. So yeah, we've been talking a lot about not identifying as the body, identifying as soul, spirit, consciousness, love. But what about when other people identify us as the body? First, of course, there's the individual level. Oh, you're hot, I'd like to take you to bed. Well, that's an identification with the body. Or, oh, you're really beautiful, you should be the model in my magazine. Again, identification with the body. Or, oh, you're really ugly, I couldn't possibly hire you for this job because identification with the body. Those are individual levels. A macro level is you're black, you're white, you're female, you're of this caste, you're of this religion, you're of this socioeconomic status, you're in a group that has to do either with the color of your skin, where you were born, who your parents are, what your gender is, what you in this body have earned and achieved and acquired. And when based on that, we have access to things or we don't have access to things. This is a two-part question because there's an inner answer and there's an outer answer and they're equally important and it wouldn't be full if we didn't do both. On an inner level, we refuse to identify as that. So you may see me as body, either on an individual level or on a macro level. But that doesn't mean I have to buy into it. Every woman in this room has had a situation in their life, probably many, in which they've been looked at by a man in such a way that it's very obvious that what he's looking at is just the body. And he's not looking at it with the thought of, God, I'd really like to get to know the soul inside, but rather, he's looking at it as an object. We have this experience. You have it growing up. You have it walking down the street. But we don't have to internalize that. For most of us, it doesn't bother us. I mean, you just understand, yeah, sometimes men are like that. I remember when I spent a year, it doesn't happen much in America, at least not in terms of like on the street heckling, but when I spent a year in Ecuador after graduating from university, you'd walk down the street and they would literally heckle you. And in the beginning, it was upsetting and off-putting and, you know, and then you realized, this isn't about me. It goes back to the earlier thing. It's not about me. It's not about who I really am anyway. It's just about my vehicle. It's like saying someone saying, hey, snazzy, nice new red car. I don't have to buy into it. I don't have to respond. I don't have to feel like a body. I don't have to feel like a sex object. And I also don't have to turn around and slap them. I don't have to respond or buy into this at all. All I have to know is not about me. Because if I'm furious and I turn around and slap them, well, then it was me that they've insulted. I've identified as the being they heckled. And that's why I'm so angry. So the mantra of not me, not me. And the same is true on this macro level. You find yourself in situations. I'll give you a personal example. We've gone to Kailash Mansarovar many times, built ashrams there. On the way, we go through Nepal. Well, in Nepal, there is a very, very, very famous, incredible temple that every time we go is part of the itinerary to go and have darshan at this sacred temple, unless you're white. The rule theoretically is you have to be Hindu, but really what the rule is, you have to be brown. And we discovered that by the fact that they would let in all kinds of brown Christians and brown Jews. I mean, it didn't matter. Nobody was checking what your religion was when you went in. Nobody was asked to recite mantras or give their, nothing. There was no qualification to get in. The guards just stood there and everybody poured in, unless you were white, at which point they'd point at you and grab you and pull you out. And I had an interesting personal experience with that, because with us was a man who worked in the Indian government. And when they stopped me, he said, I was fine with it, really fine with it. I was very happy to sit and meditate in the garden while everybody else went in for darshan. He wouldn't hear of it. He was like, this is ridiculous. And he said to the guards, but she's Hindu, she's a sannyasi, for God's sake. She's not even just a Hindu believer. She's someone who has actually taken vows of renunciation in the Hindu tradition. Ask her anything, she'll answer anything. And he says to me, start chanting some mantras. So I start chanting some mantras. And he says to the guard, can you chant those? And of course the guard can't. And then the guard says, well, you have to be Indian or Nepali Hindu. She's American Hindu. So I said, well, you know, half the group you just let in are carrying American passports, have never stepped foot in India. Like, their parents or grandparents were from India. They were born in America or in London, or because our trips into Tibet brought people from all over the world. We had hundreds of people. And they'd say, well, that doesn't matter, that doesn't matter. He clearly had no answer. As we got down point by point, well, what about this, what about that, it became abundantly clear that it was about nothing other than the color of your skin. You're brown, regardless of where you're from, regardless of your religion, you get in. You're white, regardless of where you're from, regardless of your religion, you don't. Now, I share that personal experience because you have two options. Again, here we are at a crossroad. It happened. Either I become angry, I become upset, I feel insulted. I've given my life to this religion. I'm the managing editor of the Encyclopedia of Hinduism. Like, I brought out an 11-volume encyclopedia. What other criteria do these guys need? And you could have that start to go. Or you can say, not about me. And this is true regardless of what the situation is. Now, there are a lot of, I've purposely given a personal and not very consequential example. There's obviously a depth that this goes to that becomes violence. Whether it's apartheid, by law, or whether it's not necessarily by law but simply by practice, whether it's rights of women, whether it's rights of people of certain castes, whether it's rights of people of certain colors, it's violence. But it's important for us, before we start addressing it on the outside, to address it on the inside, which is not about me. In the same way that if someone even physically attacked your body, insulted you, you understand, again, it's not about me. It's not about who I really am, because I'm not the body. I'm the consciousness, I'm the love, I'm the infinite. And if they can't see themselves in me, well, I'm going to still keep trying to see me in them. Because ultimately we're all one. And the highest goal is not, can I see you as a body, but can I see me in you? And just recognizing we're driving different cars, and to have the experience of, oh, wow, yeah, there you are in there. Yeah, I know you. But not I know this body. I know the you in the body. So that's the first step. But the second piece, and it's not really first and second, it's more just piece one and piece two, because they should happen together. The second piece is the outer part. Spirituality is not about, and I repeat this really frequently in here, spirituality is not about how can I be at peace with the problems afflicting the world. It's not about how can I be at peace with the fact that there are children starving to death. How can I be at peace with the poverty in the world? How can I be at peace with what's happening to our environment? How can I be at peace with violence? That's not the goal. Those are things we have to fight against. The goal is not, how can I, because a lot of times people come in, they say, I get so upset about it. And the answer is, yeah, we should be upset about it. In so far as our upsetness is a catalyst to action, and in so far as it doesn't render me unable to act intelligently, because I'm so angry and I've taken it so personally, that my action becomes not something that's effective, not something that actually benefits others, but just me lashing out in anger. So I need to be at peace only enough that I'm not reacting, and so that I'm able to plan, because the truth is our brains don't work very well when we're stressed. When we're really upset, we're not very good planners and thinkers. And so when something has impacted us so much that we're furious or we're deeply miserable, we're not actually going to be able to figure out the way to act against it that's effective. And that's what we are called upon to do. So we need enough upsetness that we act. Otherwise, we become complacent. So it needs to impact us deeply enough that it catalyzes in us the action. But it should not paralyze us. And these are things we need to work against. Absolutely. Because it is violence. To deprive anyone of anything that you could give them. And if I don't have the ability to give it to you, that's different. But if I've got an I, whether it's I as the government, I as an institution, if I've got the ability to give you, whether it's food, whether it's water, whether it's employment, whether it's housing, whether it's human rights, and I don't give it to you, that's violence. And we are absolutely called upon to act against violence. But we need to do it from a place of clarity. Otherwise, it just becomes a useless war. It becomes the blind fighting the blind. I'll conclude with just another personal story on this. When I first came to India, Pujaswamiji took me to see some schools in a slum because he's always been very, very committed to education, and we run a whole variety of charitable and humanitarian programs. And coincidentally, after I had come, he'd gotten a phone call from the head of a trust that was running 10 or 11 schools in this slum area, and they didn't have any money. Kids showed up every day. A teacher showed up every day in each of these schools, but they had no money. And the roof was leaking, or there was no floor, there was no electricity, and I mean, there was nothing. And he called to ask Pooja Swamiji if we would sponsor these. So he takes me to go see them. And I had never even seen a movie. I mean, Slumdog Millionaire hadn't come out yet by that point. And I hadn't seen a movie even of what an Indian slum looks like. And we walk in, and it's what slums look like. And we spent the day visiting the schools, and I'm crying. And I cry the whole way back. And when we get back to the ashram, it's dinner time. And I'm crying. I say, I can't eat dinner. Oh my God, those kids, they don't have anything. Oh my God. And he looks at me as the enlightened guru that he is, living in the light and bringing that light to those of us around him. He looks at me and he says, are your tears helping those children? And of course I had to admit no. And I said, but oh my God, the kids. Oh. And he looks at me and he says, your tears are only helping your own ego. He said, because you feel like a really compassionate person by how much you're crying and how upset you are. And he says, so it you feel good about yourself. Look how much I care. Look how upset I am. Look how deeply I'm impacted. Aren't I such a good person? He said, but don't kid yourself that your tears are helping anything other than your own ego. He said, if you really want to help those kids, eat your dinner, sleep early, get up at 5 o'clock tomorrow morning and start figuring out how to raise the money so we can adopt all 10 of those schools. And that's the teaching.
You're listening to OTRFM, part of the IOM Radio Network.
Being a radio host on IOM FM allows you to build your show on a rich platform with the power of the internet to fulfill your outreach goals and connect with a very specialized and global online audience, unlimited by time and distance. OM Times Radio will provide you with web relevance, a recognizable conscious brand, and with the standard of excellence that has accompanied every single...
Circle of Hearts Radio is a sanctuary on the airwaves. Join me, Grandmother Alaya, in the circle on Sunday, 2 p.m. Eastern, as I share information to both enlighten and nourish your soul.
Hi, this is Christina Ricci with RAIN. Every 2 minutes, another American is sexually assaulted. If you or someone you know has been sexually assaulted, you are not alone. Help is just a call or click away through the National Sexual Assault Hotline. Please call 1-800-656-HOPE, that's H-O-P-E, or visit rain.org, that's RAINN.ORG.
Brought to you by RAIN and this station.
Welcome back to Inspiration and Transformation. I'm so glad to have you all back here with me. If God made us perfectly, why do we practice pratyahara, or the withdrawal of the senses? God gave us eyes to see, ears to hear, noses to smell, hands to touch, tongues to taste. So why should we withdraw the senses? A bit of background for those of you not from the yoga tradition. In the eight limbs of yoga, as the sage Patanjali gave to us, he gave limbs that move from the yamas and the niyamas of how we live through asana, what we do with the body, through pranayama, the breath, and then we start moving inward. So we go pratyahara, we withdraw the senses inward, dharana, which is a single pointed focus, then dhyana, meditation, and then ultimately the eighth limb of samadhi, or divine bliss, ecstasy, union, enlightenment. So pratyahara, why do sensory withdrawal if God has given us these wonderful eyes to see, ears to hear, noses to smell, fingers to touch, tongues to taste? Why withdraw them? It's a great question. Because one of the things that I emphasize so frequently is God doesn't make mistakes. And so what God gives us clearly is for a purpose. If we feel emotion, if we feel sadness, if we have tears that cry, if we feel love, well, these are things we're supposed to feel. So, senses. Why would we withdraw our senses if God has given them to us? Just because God has given us a gift doesn't mean that he, she, it, however we envision the divine, meant for us to use that gift recklessly. So, yes, we have tongues that taste, but that doesn't mean we should eat everything. We have fingers that touch, doesn't mean we should touch everything. Anybody who's ever touched a hot burner, a leaf of poison ivy, a snake, knows clearly this was not what God intended when we were given the ability to sense. Was not for us to get hurt. So just because we have the senses doesn't mean that we're supposed to use them recklessly. We also have sexual organs. God's given them to us. Doesn't mean that we're supposed to go out just because we have sexual organs, go out and have sex with everybody. Doesn't mean we're supposed to have sex all the time. Just because God has given us something doesn't mean use it with reckless abandon. Use it however you want. Everything we've been given for a purpose. And the sense organs have been given to us so that we can know the outer world. You are sitting in front of me. I'm aware of that. That's part of my knowledge. But how did it become part of my knowledge? Because my organs of sight have seen you. Or if maybe I were blind and I didn't have eyes that saw, but you spoke, I would be able to hear you. Maybe you have a scent, so I was able to smell you. If you're interacting with someone who can neither see nor hear, what we have is touch. We reach out, we touch them. Blind people frequently will want to touch your face so they can recognize you. But we need at least one functional organ of sensation to know the outer world. If I don't have sight, sound, smell, touch, because I certainly can't taste you, so I would need you to have one of those four. If I don't have any of those four functioning, you could still be here, of course, but I would have no way of knowing that. Our only way to know the outer world is these organs of sensation. But what about the inner world? How are we supposed to know the inner world? Every scripture, every teaching, every saint, every sage, every master reminds us over and over and over again, the real world is the inner one. I need my organ of touch so that when I put my hand on a hot stove, I'm able to remove it immediately. If I didn't have sensory neurons, that worked immediately in my spinal cord, connecting to the motor neurons that were going to bring my hand off the stove. I would leave it there. I would burn myself. And after a few seconds, I would give myself such a burn that it would become infected. Could get septic. I could die. So the organ of sensation, all of them, are very, very important to help us interact with the world around us. You're walking through the jungle. You hear the distinct rattle of a rattlesnake. Or, depending on which jungle you happen to be in, you hear a far-off roar of a lion. Whatever your jungle may be, that sound makes us know, maybe it's better to go backwards. Maybe not to keep heading in this direction. Or you're driving your car and you hear a very, very loud horn. Puts you on alert. Suddenly it's alerted you to the fact that there's a car that ran a red light and it's about to hit you. So these senses are of great importance. They help us navigate the world. You wake up in the middle of the night to go to the bathroom, or anytime actually. Walking down, if you don't have your organ of sight, fall down your stairs on the way to the bathroom. Hit your head, die. Our organs of sensation keep us alive and healthy and help us interact with the world. Everything we do in the outer world is rooted in these. But as we are reminded over and over again, the real world is the inner world. And this is where pratyahara comes in. If we want to achieve samadhi, if we want to achieve enlightenment, we want to achieve divine yogic union, bliss, ecstasy. Well, before that comes meditation. But before I can meditate, I have to take this crazy mind that's in 1,000 places and put it in one place. A mantra, a candle flame, an image. But before I can even do that, I have to stop my organs of sensation and therefore perception from being rooted in the outer world. That's why it's very, very difficult to meditate while you're in the middle of a basketball game. In the middle of a basketball court, you've got to keep your eyes open, or a soccer field, or wherever you may be, or a supermarket, or driving your car. Anything you're doing that requires you to be focused outward on the other cars, on the other players of your sports team, that requires you to be listening, seeing, touching, moving. It's very difficult to meditate in that moment because your perception, which happens in the mind, is rooted in the sensory organs that face outward. So it's taking in the sensation, processing them as perception in my mind, enabling me to drive my car or play basketball or walk down the street or whatever I'm doing. Which is why when we go to meditate, what's the first thing we do? We close our eyes. We try to choose a place that's quiet. If we can't, we put in earplugs or we listen to chanting of Om. Because I have to be able to draw my senses inward in order for me to put them onto the one thing I'm going to focus on. Whether it's my mantra, whether it's a candle, whether it's an image, whether it's my breath. And from that single pointed focus, I'm able to merge into a state of meditation. And from that, I'm able, with grace, to experience samadhi. But the pratyahara is the crucial first step. So for the outer world, our sensory organs, we tell God, thank you very much for the fact that I didn't fall down the stairs today. I was able to hear, took my hand off the hot stove. I'm able to see a rainbow, to see a sunset, to see the faces of my loved ones, to hear the sound of my loved ones. But now thank you for this inner world where I can see you and hear you. So we need both.
This is OTRFM, part of the IOM radio network.
OM Times Magazine is one of the leading online content providers of positivity, wellness, and personal empowerment. A philanthropic organization, their net proceeds are funneled to support worldwide charity initiatives via Humanity Healing International. Through their commitment to creating community and providing conscious content, they aspire to uplift humanity on a global scale. OM Times, co-creating a more conscious lifestyle.
Do you have time to read that inspiring book or that blog post you've been meaning to get to? In your busy world, how do you improve yourself and keep your life going? I'm Lisa Kay, and my Between Heaven and Earth radio show can transform your life just by listening. Be uplifted with inspiring topics, positive stories, and ideas that really work. Between Heaven and Earth radio is conscious living for your soul every Wednesday at 4 p.m. Eastern Time.
Baldwin with People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals. I grew up loving circuses and other traveling animal shows, but it never occurred to me what life might be like for the animals. Training wild animals to do things they don't understand takes force. Routine discipline with a hook or whip with the heel of a boot shows the animal exactly who's the boss. Don't patronize animal acts. Please contact People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals.
757-622-PETA.
Welcome back. This is Sadhvi Bhagavati Saraswati with inspiration and transformation. How do we practice giving and receiving unconditional love? So here's what's interesting. We're taught, those of us with values and ethics or sanskaras would be told, that giving is more important than receiving. Right? To give is the most important thing. So many cultures, so many values, Indian culture in particular, is really rooted in giving. This is true for everything except love. Because turns out I actually cannot give love unconditionally until I'm able to experience it in myself. I cannot give it because I don't have it. So my intention may be very pure. I might want to love you unconditionally, but as long as I'm not able to love myself, I'm actually not able to give you that. And so love has to be something where no matter how selfless we want to be, how spiritual we want to be, what great givers we want to be, we have to start with ourselves. And when we talk about loving ourselves unconditionally, it's important that we recognize that what we're loving unconditionally is the capital S self. It's the core of who we are. It's the soul. It's the spirit. It's the essence. It's consciousness. It is love. I may not love the fact that I'm addicted to smoking, and I shouldn't love that. I may not love the fact that I'm an alcoholic. I may not love the fact that I beat my children, and I shouldn't love any of those things. And the path is not, how can I love the fact that I hit my kids? How can I love the fact that I'm an alcoholic? How can I love the fact that I have a temper? But what the practice of unconditional love says is all of these things that I do, stem out of my inability to see myself, to understand myself, and to love myself. When I don't love myself and I feel empty, hence I drink alcohol. I'm trying to fill myself up. I'm numbing myself. I'm escaping. When I feel empty, I need you to act in a certain way in order for me to feel okay. When you do, I'm great. When you don't, I'm furious. Hence, that's where my anger comes from. And to understand that all of these things that I do, while they are not right at all and should be changed, they stem not because I'm a bad person, not because I'm evil at the core or dark at the core, but they stem because I haven't yet seen. They stem because I'm living behind a veil. And when I'm really able to see myself first, what I see is consciousness. What I see is divinity. What I see is love. And yeah, this body, this vehicle has been through a lot. It's had a lot of challenges. A lot of things have happened to it that have created patterns of ignorance in my own mind. When I allow those patterns of ignorance to run my show, I act in ways that I later regret. When I allow those patterns of ignorance to run my show, I feel about myself in a way that's not true. So, let's say I was abused as a child. Well, when we're abused as a child, the message we get is, you deserve it. There's something wrong. Usually that's what we're told verbally anyway. You're bad, that's why I'm hurting you. If you were a good girl, I wouldn't be hurting you. But even if they don't say it verbally, the message is clear. I've done something wrong. I am wrong. Therefore, I deserve it. It's only decades later with a lot of therapy or a great guru that we realize, oh, wait, it wasn't about me. It was about them. Oh, my God, I didn't do something wrong. I was just a kid. It was their mistake. But that's not what runs in the patterns in our mind. What runs in the patterns of our mind is this ignorance of, I'm wrong. I'm bad. I'm dark. Otherwise, they wouldn't have to be hitting me. Otherwise, they wouldn't have to hurt me. Otherwise, this situation wouldn't happen. My best friend wouldn't have died. My sister wouldn't have died. My mother wouldn't have died. We get these patterns in our mind when we're young that literally blame ourselves for everything. There's a way of thinking that children do called magical thinking. And it's just an aspect of child development. And what it is that we think that we have power over everything. It's a beautiful phase of life. We really think I can do anything. Look, I cry, mom comes, there's a breast in my mouth, it's all good. The universe is in my hands. And in this magical thinking child brain, we really feel like everything that happens is because of us. So even if it's not something directly to us, it's not that we've actually been abused or been told something, but just something bad happens. One of our siblings passes away, a parent passes away, our parents get divorced. The house burns down. In the child's mind, they're the ones to blame. So we actually move through this world with patterns in our mind of ignorance that prevent us from loving ourselves. Because even though I've grown up to be a CEO or I founded this NGO and we feed 5 million people in Africa every day. So objectively, everybody, you know, thinks I'm wonderful and I've gotten these awards, but inside, I still don't feel worthy. because it's patterns that are so deep that have nothing to do with what I'm doing today and everything to do with this subconscious patterning. And so today, when it's about receiving love, first we have to understand who we are is divine. And all of the rest of it is ignorance. Doesn't mean we're bad. Ignorance does not translate as yet another person saying you're stupid. So it's not that you walk out of here, yeah, see, I knew I was stupid and she just told me I'm stupid. And it's just, it's the ignorance of the mind and the ego that says, I am this body, I am what's happened to it, that's absorbed all of the messages of our culture, of marketing, of our parents, of everything that's happened to us. The sum total of that message is, you're not worthy. You're not good enough. Why can't you be like your brother? Why can't you be like your sister? When I was your age, we've all got a different way that message went into us. But the end result is the same. You're not good enough. You're not worthy. And that's what needs to be broken first. And now here's the beautiful thing that happens between that and loving you unconditionally. The minute I'm able to actually love myself, I'm sitting here experiencing love. Something that I always thought I needed someone else to give me. Something I was always looking for outside. Well, now here I am, sitting alone, experiencing love. And what that teaches me directly and instinctively and experientially and automatically is, I don't need you to behave in a certain way or speak in a certain way or do something so that I can feel okay. And the minute I can let that go, then I'm actually able to love you unconditionally. Because as long as I need you to be a certain way in order for me to feel okay, then I cannot love you unconditionally. You bring me flowers, you bring me chocolate, cook me nice meals, tell me I'm beautiful, wait on me hand and foot. I love you. It's great. Stop doing that. Well, it no longer feels so great. And if I don't have a source of that love within me, I'm going to be really angry at you. I'm not going to be able to articulate it like that, because chances are I'm not aware of it like that. But what I know is I no longer love you. Well, it's not that. It's that you're no longer filling the parts of me that are holes. I need to be told I'm beautiful. You told me I'm beautiful. Now I'm good. You stop telling me I'm beautiful. Now I'm stuck with this hole. I don't feel happy. I blame that on you because you used to make me happy. So my love is conditional. But the minute I'm not dependent on that, because I love myself, I certainly hope you love me also. Because then it just multiplies. I mean, it's so much greater to love lots of people and feel love from lots of people than just from yourself. But we no longer need it. You know, it's like if you go out to eat with a bunch of friends and you're eating food like Indian food or any type of Asian food usually, where it's people share. Western food tends to be like your plate separate, your plate separate, your plate separate. But most, whether it's Indian or Thai or Chinese, most of it is they just bring out lots of bowls on the table and everybody sort of takes a little bit here, a little bit there. Now, I could have my own food already. I've ordered something. But if I'm sitting at a table with you all, isn't it so much more fun to also have a bite of yours and a bite of yours and a taste of that and to say to you, oh, you've got to have a spoonful of this. It's so good. But then if you say to me, no, I don't want it. I don't like sog. I'm okay with that because, see, I've got a plate of food in front of me. Or I say to you, oh, I want to taste your gobi. And you say, oh, no, I don't want to share my gobi with you. Okay. I'm okay because I've got a plate full of food. But if I were starving and my plate were empty and I needed your cauliflower to live, I wouldn't be able to take the no, I don't want to give you any cauliflower so easily. Our plate has to be full first. Only then can I love you even when you refuse to give me cauliflower.
This is OTR-FM, part of the IOM Radio Network.
The number one reason girls drop out of school in sub-Saharan Africa is lack of access to feminine hygiene products. The Pads for Schoolgirls Project, an outreach of Humanity Healing International, is changing this paradigm by setting up sewing programs at schools, teaching girls a vocational skill, while producing the reusable pads that help keep them attending classes. The girls pay it forward by making and giving pad kits to other girls in need. To learn more, visit humanityhealing.org. Humanity Healing is where your heart is.
Circle of Hearts Radio is a sanctuary on the airwaves. Join me, Grandmother Elia, in the circle on Sunday, 2 p.m. Eastern, as I share information to both enlighten and nourish your soul.
When I broke my foot,
for leaving me alone when I wanted to be alone.
And now, as a grown-up, I'm thankful for being able to take care of you, my dear mom, for taking you to your therapies, for understanding that sometimes you simply want to be alone.
Roles change without us noticing. That's why AARP gives you the information to provide even better care for your loved one. Visit aarp.org/caregiving. Brought to you by AARP and the Ad Council.
Welcome back. This is Sadhvi Bhagavati Saraswati, and thanks for coming back and joining us for more of inspiration and transformation. He said, if we can see the truth in many different ways, from many different paths, in the Hindu scriptures, there's a beautiful teaching that says the truth is one, the sages call it by different names. In another teaching, we're told, let all the noble thoughts come from all the directions. So we've got this teaching rooted in the idea that there's so many different ways of getting at the truth. He said, but then how do you know which one is right when they seem to be conflicting? Where there is conflict, you can actually be pretty sure there isn't truth. The truth, for it to be real, there's two types of truth. We've got our capital T truth, eternal truth, unchanging truth, the truth of the stuff that our scriptures are made of that's just as true today in Manhattan or Paris or New York or London, as was true in Kurukshetra or Ayodhya or anywhere thousands and thousands of years ago. And then you've got what we'll call our lowercase t truth. It's still true, it's not a lie, but it's true at this intersection of time and space. So right now it's 7:22 p.m. It is the 30th of March. That's true. I'm not lying. Look at a calendar, look at the clock. And yet, it's lowercase t because it's only true for us. If you pick up the phone and you call someone in London or California, it's not 7:22 for them. And it's not even going to be true for us in 60 seconds, at which point it'll be 7:23. Wasn't true for us a minute ago when it was 7:21. So it's only true at this intersection of time and space. Where you get conflict is in lowercase t truths. So you could get on the phone with someone in California and you could say, it's 7:23. And they would say, no, it's not. It's 6:53 in the morning. True for them, true for you. But if you didn't have the wisdom to understand the fact that you were both right, you could get into a big fight over it. It is not morning. What are you talking about? Look outside. It's dark. Are you crazy? Are you blind? The person would say to you, what are you blind? It's sunny. The sun is up. It's gorgeous. It's a brand new day. If you started fighting enough, you could actually start killing each other over it. Conflict arises with lowercase t truth when we try to turn it into capital T truth. It's hot in this room. My experience. Somebody else could say, no, it's not. We're in the same room, same time, same place, different experiences. This meal is too spicy. Same food, same time, same dish, sitting across the table from each other. Entirely different experiences of the food. Now, most of us have the wisdom to understand that I could be hot while you could be cool. I could enjoy the food while you're sweating out of your scalp. It could be night for us and morning for someone else. But now you imagine if I decided that my experience of this food was not just lowercase t-truth, but was capital T-truth. This food is perfect. That is canon. And for you to so much as insinuate that you're sweating out of your scalp is sacrilege. Now, all that's happened is I have taken my experience of the truth and turned it into a global, timeless, eternal, all-pervasive truth. My mistake. But should I happen to be someone with a lot of followers and a lot of power, I actually could try to start a movement of the fact that anyone who thought that chilies were spicy should be shot and killed. Chilies are great. Food is horrible without them. They are a crucial aspect of a meal. Anybody with any other thought should be hanged. You see where things start to go awry. If it's real truth, the truth that our scriptures talk about, the truth that may have different names but is one, there actually isn't conflict. There may be conflict in interpretation of that, because typically those truths come from scriptures that tend to be written in ancient languages. We are dependent upon different people to translate and interpret those for us. And people who are translating and interpreting are human, they're fallible. God knows they might also be biased or have their own agenda. So what you end up with are different interpretations or translations. But if you actually had the ability to understand in its original language, what you would know is there is no conflict in that truth. If it's capital T truth, it's the same for everyone. This brings to a close this hour of inspiration and transformation. Thank you so much for joining me. I'm so glad to be together with you all each week, and I look forward to being together again next Thursday, same time, on Om Times Radio.